Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 24th of April. The author of The Lucifer Effect is with us this hour, understanding how good people turn evil. Philip Zimbardo is professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford University, also taught at Yale, NYU, and Columbia, co-author of Psychology in Life, and the author of Shyness. He has been president of the American Psychological Association, is now director of the Stanford Center on Interdisciplinary Policy Education and Research on Terrorism. He also narrated the award-winning PBS series Discovering Psychology. And in the year 2004, he acted as an expert witness in the court-martial hearings of one of the American Army reservists who was accused of criminal behavior in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And he saw very many similarities between Abu Ghraib and what happened in 1971 when he performed an infamous experiment at Stanford University, the Stanford Prison Experiment. Nice middle-class young men turned sadistic, a group of students randomly divided into guards and inmates and placed in a mock prison environment. A good deal of the book looks at that. It also looks at genocide in Rwanda, mass suicide and murder of people's temple followers in the jungles of Guyana, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, the horrors of Nazi concentration camps, sexual abuse of parishioners by Catholic priests, the lines of continuity between scandalous, fraudulent behavior of executives at Enron and WorldCom corporations. But it's not also evil. It also, there are some people who resist. And so he celebrates the resistors as well. And we'll talk about what it is that can be built perhaps inside each of us to resist evil. So we have a lot to talk about this hour. And it should be just a fascinating hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Professor Zimbardo, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Colleen. I'm glad to be in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So the similarities between Abu Ghraib, and fascinating it is that you became involved in Abu Ghraib as well in the Stanford Prison Experiment. I mean, so many years have gone by, but you probably had one of those aha moments when you discovered the horrors at Abu Ghraib because you knew that it could happen with fine, upstanding, middle-class young men at Stanford.
Absolutely, Colleen. The Lucifer effect, I mean, you outlined a lot of the grim stuff, and I'm glad you ended with the there is a lot of positive sunshine that comes in at the end.
Yes.
But you know, like most of your listeners, I was shocked when those pictures surfaced, actually just about 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Of, you know, American soldiers, men and women, abusing the prisoners who were supposed to be in their protection. But I wasn't at all shocked. I mean, I was shocked, but I was not at all surprised because, you know, the visual images were the same as in my Stanford prison study 35 years earlier. Guards stripping prisoners naked, putting bags over their head, and then finally, you know, forcing them to engage in sexually degrading activities. And if you remember what happened immediately, the generals got on, the Bush administration spokespeople got on, say, just a few bad soldiers,
right,
a few rogue, right, rogue soldiers. Don't blame the system. And I said, well, I knew that the way I had set up my experiment on day one, I knew I put only good apples in a bad barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, you know, whether these were these really bad American soldiers or were they good soldiers corrupted by a bad barrel. And fortunately, I was then invited to be on the defense team for one of the soldiers who was in charge, actually, of the night shift where all the abuses took place. And that allowed me to really switch from being just a college professor to almost an investigative reporter. So I found out everything there is to know about him, the other soldiers, and about Abu Ghraib, and then the system that created it. So
yeah.
My conclusion is, good apples, bad barrel. Same mm-hmm. story, 1971
hmm.
or 2003.
Mm-hmm. You became, to him and his wife, what did you call it? Say, Uncle Phil was your name? You were an informed psychological counselor?
It was painful to write this book, although and now that I'm so glad I got it out of my system.
Yeah.
First of all, to get back into the Stanford Prison Experiment, I immersed myself in the 12 hours of videotapes we had taken, and then I made typescripts of it, and a lot of the presentation of that old study is presented in great detail, great depth, using mostly the words of the kids who played prisoners and guards.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did the same with Abu Ghraib, getting totally immersed in that situation. So much so I had this Sergeant Chip Frederick, who's the person I defended. He was a military police Army reservist in charge of that night shift. I had him and his wife come out to California. I interviewed them, had psychological testing done on him by the military. And then while I was writing the book, I am sending email messages to his wife. I'm writing to him, and they're writing back to me. They're now going through, they were going through a divorce, and I'm like on the side, a marriage counselor. And you're right.
Gee.
They refer to me as dear Uncle Phil.
Oh, gee. You say that there's a large body of evidence in social psychology supporting the concept that situational power triumphs over individual power in given contexts. Can you put that into the Stanford context or the Abu Ghraib context to give us a better understanding of what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. You hit right on the core of what the Lucifer Effect is all about. It's really, I'm trying to understand, actually, from the time I was a little kid growing up in the South Bronx ghetto, surrounded by evil, of my friends who are good kids doing really bad stuff, many ending up in prison, what accounts for that transformation of, you know, people who are ordinary good people, good citizens, good kids, good adults, who first begin to engage in what we could call evil, that is, harming other people in various ways, hurting other people intentionally, exercising the power to do this. And the issue is, either it's something wrong with them,
mm-hmm.
or it's something about the situations that they live in or operate in. And the analysis of the Stanford Prison Study, and then in my book I have two whole chapters on a whole body of psychological science that supports the idea that it is powerful situational forces that, especially when we're in new situations, that can transform us, that can corrupt us. And in the book, I lay out exactly what are all of those different things.
Mm-hmm. And talk about, because this seems to be a common, it's a process of, what's the word, de-individuation? Is
right.
that the right word?
Yeah, it's an ugly word. But so one of the things, for example, is that, you know, when we are accountable for our behavior, when we know that other people are observing what we do, and if you step out of line, you're going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But there are situations when our individual identity is blunted or taken away. When we're in a group, when we're in a mob, when we're in the dark, when our identity is concealed, like with a mask at Mardi Gras,
mm-hmm.
then suddenly we can do things knowing at a deep psychological level, we are not accountable. We can get away with it.
Hmm.
And so anything that makes us anonymous increases the likelihood that we do vandalism, we become vandals, or we become worse. Other things are diffusion of responsibility. When you think you are not personally responsible for your behavior, but some boss, some foreman, some authority says, I will be responsible. Keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you are ultimately responsible for your behavior, but you say, oh, good, you know, it's not all me. Anything that allows you to dehumanize the other, that is, think of them as not your kind, not your kin, but in the worst, as animals.
Right.
And that's what prejudice does. It's
right.
labels we put on other people that take away their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are some of the kinds of things which make actors, we're all actors playing different roles. You know, as Shakespeare says, you know, all the world is a stage, and we're just actors. And it depends on, is there an audience or not? Are you in costume or not? What are the stage props? And who is your director that you may or may not be aware of?
Mm-hmm. And that propaganda technique of taking away the humanity is also used, we think of it in terms of the Nazis, but it's used in genocide, in so many, in racial prejudice as well. It's just across the board, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the amazing thing about the Nazis and Hitler and his propaganda machine is that it was so ahead of the time and being so, in a sense, psychologically sophisticated.
Hmm.
You know, in a very short time, they created an enemy called the Jew. And they got people, they had high, elementary school kids had to read comic books with images of the dirty Jew compared to the wonderful Aryan, Aryan man. And in these books, they had every conceivable negative stereotype of Jews, at the end of which Jews get kicked out of school, kicked out of the country. And it seems, if you're a little kid, reasonable that that should be the consequence of these terrible things. But this was perverting the whole school system in order to achieve this end. And in Rwanda, you know, there were two main cultural groups, the Hutus and the Tutsis, that lived side by side for years. One day, the government, the military junta government in Rwanda, went on the radio saying, Hutus, that your neighbors, the Tutsis, are not your neighbors. They are vile. They are cockroaches. You must destroy them, or they're going to destroy our way of life. And they went around giving the men machetes and the women clubs. And they went next door and started massacring their neighbors.
Yeah.
In 3 months, 800,000 Tutsis were killed by their neighbors. And the weapon of mass destruction is not a nuclear bomb. It's a club or a machete. And so anybody could be labeled your enemy. With a little ideology, and it's usually national security, or the communists are the enemy, or the fascists are the enemy. It doesn't even make doesn't matter what the reality is. It's somebody in power labels somebody else as the enemy and gives you a weapon.
Right, and these is it's chilling when you read this. You talk about the French journalist who interviewed 10 of the Hutu militia members who are now in prison, and they just, as you write, are chilling in their matter of fact. Remorseless depiction of unimaginable cruelty. And these are just regular people. They're farmers, they're churchgoers, they're teachers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, again, it's we really want to believe that there's a line between good and evil. We are the good folks on this side, and those are the bad folks over there. And we could never become them, and they can't become us. And what I try to do throughout the Lucifer Effect is dispel that notion to say, you know, the line is permeable, that people go back and forth all the time. In every one of the cases of a school shooting or a mass murder, it is almost always everybody says, I don't know how that could happen. He was a good little boy. He was quiet. He never said no to his mother. He was a Boy Scout, et cetera, et cetera. And you realize that we don't really know ourselves that well, we don't really know other people that well, because we see ourselves or other people only in a small number of familiar situations. Because we have freedom to choose the situation we enter, every day in our life is really more like yesterday than it is like a new adventure. You know, we arrange our life to be in safe, predictable, sure situations. That means so we don't know how we would behave if suddenly, you know, the Nazi government took over, or if suddenly we were in the Stanford prison study as a guard, or in Rwanda, or in these other places. And so it's comforting to say, no, I would never do it. And what I try to do in the Lucifer Effect is to say, you know, don't be so, don't rush to that judgment, because anything any human being has ever done, it now becomes imaginable, and you have to say, maybe I could have been seduced to do that in the same situation.
Yeah, and you're even... I wouldn't say hard on yourself, but you certainly examine yourself in this book as well, in your role in the Stanford prison experiment, don't you? It sounds as though it was really hard for you to look at all of this all these years later.
It was terrible. I mean, you know, in the Stanford prison study, you know, we picked 24 boys out of 75 who had applied for a study of prison life, gave them a battery of psychological tests, interviewed them, and the ones we picked were the most normal and healthy, and then the basis of all research is we randomly assigned half to be guards and half to be prisoners, gave them uniforms. It was like a play. Gave them the prop setting. We had a very realistic prison environment in the basement psychology department. And then we let them improvise. And in a matter of days, the guards are abusing the prisoners more extremely every day. The prisoners are having emotional breakdowns, normal, healthy kids having emotional breakdowns. And so I have to end the study after 6 days because it's out of control. But in going back and looking at the videos, I'm saying to myself, Zimbardo, end the study. Why'd you let it go on? Why are you letting it go on? Kids are really suffering, and you are responsible. But the mistake I made is I became the prison superintendent as well as the principal investigator.
Right.
If you're a prison superintendent, you don't stop your prison because, you know, a couple of prisoners break down. And that was the mistake. I did it because there was so much logistics to take care of. It was just me and two graduate students, Craig Haney, Kurt Banks, and one undergraduate. And the prisoners lived there, you know, 24/7. The guards worked 8-hour shifts. So it was just endless logistics about feeding them. And we had parents' days and prison chaplain come down and public defender and police and parole board. So it was really overwhelming, but it was still, I made the mistake. I should have had somebody else play that role.
Mm. Yeah. Well, then you wouldn't have had as compelling a book, you know, 35 years later. Yeah. So maybe.
But anyway, in the book, I say, I am guilty. You know, I am guilty of allowing the suffering to go on way, way too long.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is the author of The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. And we'll soon get to, before we go to phone calls, you know, how do people resist this, too? How do we build that in our world? Philip Zimbardo is professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford University, also taught at Yale, NYU, and Columbia. He's written a number of books, and he is the narrator, and I believe that he created this award-winning PBS series, Discovering Psychology. In 2004, he acted as an expert witness in the court-martial hearings of one of the American Army reservists accused of criminal behavior in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And he's also the creator of the infamous experiment at Stanford, the Stanford Prison Experiment, back in 1971, and the book looks at that as well. So join us, okay? Our lines, well, you can't right now. Our lines are busy. But eventually you'll be able to. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Professor Philip Zimbardo. His book is The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. It has just been published and is doing very well by Random House. Let's start with Bruce from Oshkosh. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. Dr. Zimbardo, very timely in view of Virginia Tech. When I was teaching from your books for the past 30 years,
oh my!
I learned a great deal of psychology from Dr. Zimbardo by teaching it, and I wanted to share this with Dr. Zimbardo. When I was teaching in Japan, my students taught me the reason there is so little violence and pilferage and cheating on exams, neighborhood vandalism. Each of them, in an individual interview, gave me the answer that our ancestors are watching.
Oh, wow.
And they pointed to heaven, and it didn't matter what their religious background was. It seems to be culture-wide. And so, in addition to thanking you for your entire life's work, for those of us in psychology, I wanted to ask you to please address the therapeutic changes that we might work in situations to turn against evil and to stop our own misbehavior.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because I think we've all been in those shoes.
Yeah.
I was military, and I can understand that.
What a great first call, huh?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I want to take him home. but, you know, it's, again, you know, the sad thing about the Virginia Tech shooting is that it's not the first. This is the 11th in the past decade, and it won't be the last. And I just came back from London, and they were obsessed about it. I mean, the BBC had it on CNN constantly. Mm. But, again, the analysis is totally wrong because it focuses only on the individual. Let's get in the mind of this murderer.
Right.
If it was the only one, then you say, okay, let's look at the person. But given that it's the 11th one, then you have to say, is there an underlying pattern? Can we look at what is the situation that creates and sustains young men like this to become killers? And then is it really different than in Iraq now or in Palestine where we have suicide bombers? In almost every one of these cases of mass shootings, they end up killing themselves. So they are, in a sense, suicide bombers with guns rather than bombs. And in my book, I do have an analysis of suicide bombers in Palestine to say these are not fanatics. These are people who have a rage. They believe there's injustice against, in that case, against Israel, now in Iraq, against the United States. And there's a process of training them to become suicide bombers. here with this sad young man, and I mourn his death as well as the 32 others he killed, is that what we see is at the end of the line. But if you look through the videos, when you listen to the video, he's saying, you know, I was bullied, I was teased, I was shunned, I didn't have a friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I stopped talking to people, and few people noticed. So the ones that noticed never followed through to help me go to therapy or give me support. And so I am acting out my rage. Well, how many other kids are like that throughout our whole country, where they are isolated, alienated, especially if you come from a different culture, a different race? And now we have guns. So
right,
almost any
right.
kid can go in his father's
right.
closet and pull out a weapon which is loaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Bruce is saying, you know, the culture is also responsible. It's not just the shooter. It's the culture that makes guns available. And not only makes them available, we worship guns. There are movies about Winchester 76, Colt 45. We worship guns. Rush Limbaugh said this could have been prevented if people at Virginia Tech had concealed
guns. I know, there's the answer, right?
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
Guns. Yeah, I mean, he's saying we should need more guns so, you know, kids in the class, if they all had guns, could have shot this kid and killed him. So, you know, so that's the bizarre.
Yeah.
That's how bizarre our culture has gotten, to say we need more guns rather than gun control.
Yeah. And can you spend just a few moments talking about our worship of violence as well? Why is it that this culture is so filled with violent videos and these crazy violent movies that are, I won't even go to, they're just awful. What's that all about?
Well, see, I mean, and it's, you know, I would say it's not new. I mean, let me put it differently. It's, you know, in the interviews I've been doing, lots of people call and say, why are we fascinated with evil? You know, why, you know, if you look at the nightly news, I mean, for every one positive story, you know, of a fireman taking a kitten down from a tree, there's 10 stories about, you know, rape and abuse.
Right.
And I think it's really the fascination with evil. It's not about the consequences, how many people died. It's really about it's seeing the exercise of power, that somebody has the power to control, to dominate other people or nature, animals.
Hmm.
And I think at some deep level, that's what we identify with. You know, and evil, as with, you know, violence, is that somebody out there, this little kid, I mean, he's like a nothing, and suddenly he's going to go down, at least for a while in history, as the shooter of the biggest mass murder in America, 32. He gets the record for 32 until somebody, you know, puts it up to 40.
Right. But,
so I think it's that. I mean, and so video games that kids are obsessed with, I have relatives who spend 8 hours, teenagers, all day Saturday playing these games from morning to night, and almost every one of them are violent. You know, you get a blood count. Well, kids didn't make up the games. There are people who are making a lot of money designing these games. There are technicians, you know, computer experts,
mm-hmm.
Game experts,
mm-hmm.
who are catering to this fascination with evil.
Right.
And the more you play the games, the more embedded you get into it. And you really get numbed. You get numb to killing, to blood, etc.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce, very much for the call. Let's go next to Alex from Madison. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Kathleen, and hello to the guests. Fascinating program. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think an important question to ask is, what is the basic nature of man? Is the basic nature of man good and somehow we're led astray, or is the basic nature of man intrinsically evil and we have to struggle to do the good thing? Yeah, I think the inescapable truth is it's the latter much more than the former, and you know, we see the concept of inherited sin in religion. It's certainly embedded in the literature. I mean, Graham Greene and George Orwell immediately come to mind, and also the founding fathers, when you know, they knew about the evilness of man, and that's why they put in a system of checks and balances in three branches of government, and toss in the fourth estate with the press. So I think we have to struggle to do the good thing and the right thing, the dark side, if I can use a Star Wars analogy, it's quick, it's easy, it's seductive, but perhaps not more powerful. I'll listen on
okay.
the radio, and thanks a lot.
Thanks, Alex, for the call.
Oh, great. Well, Alex, you cover a lot of points. I mean, the basic point you raise is an age-old one, not only in psychology, but I guess philosophy, is it nature? Are we born with, you know, the genes or a bad seed that push us in this direction, or is it nurture? Is it our upbringing, the environment around us that has the greater influence? Psychologists and most other people now agree it's always what they call an interaction. It's, you know, we certainly are born with a genetic inheritance that goes back to, you know, millennia, but whatever genes we have are always shaped by the environment. So, for example, if your mother is schizophrenic and your father is schizophrenic, what is the likelihood you'll be schizophrenic? It's only 50%. That is, with the most extreme genetic inheritance of that kind, half of their kids are normal and half are like them schizophrenic. So that says, at that point, what pushes you in those extreme directions is something about your upbringing. And the upbringing is not just the same environment at home. Kids are in different environments in school. You have different friends and so forth. The analysis I try to lay out in the Lucifer Effect is that people are really not born good or evil. We're born with templates. We have a human mind, which is so incredible. It has the infinite capacity to make any of us be kind or cruel, caring or indifferent, creative, destructive. And so it pushes some of us to become heroes while others become villains.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, I mean, it's in thinking of the, you know, are we born good or bad? That's really too simple. It's we are born with mental templates to be anything, to be Mother Teresa or to be Hitler.
Hmm.
And what I'm arguing then is it's the situations that we find ourselves embedded in. So imagine you're a kid growing up now in Baghdad. How does that differ if you're a kid growing up in Chevy Chase, Maryland, or, you know, whatever's affluent suburb in Madison, those environments shape you. You grow up in a war zone, grow up in a city ghetto versus growing up in a suburb. You know, that has to transform who you are.
Mm-hmm. All right, before we get too far into the hour, I got to get to the sunshine at the end before
okay,
you're back to phone calls.
Yes,
so
yes.
Why, and let's frame it in terms of the Holocaust, because we're all familiar with that and we're familiar with the horrors. We're not as familiar with those who resisted and understanding why they did that when they knew they could die.
Right. Yeah, see, the interesting thing about the Holocaust is that, you know, it's in a kind of historical time capsule. So it's you know, we could talk about that, you know, with ease. Again, the fascination with the Holocaust was the fascination with Hitler, with, you know, with this powerful system he created that transformed Germany and it was almost much of the world. Nobody asked the question, did anybody help? For 20 years after the Holocaust, we're fascinated with the horrors of the concentration camps. And then somebody said, but did anybody help the Jews? And the answer is, of course, in every single country. There were people who helped the Jews. There were networks set up to help the Jews. I think that in the museum in Jerusalem, the Holocaust Museum, they list like 2,400 names that people they've tracked down. And you know what? In almost every case, when they interviewed those people, they said it was nothing special. I did what I had to do. How could anybody not do this? I end the Lucifer Effect with, say, in almost every one of these experiments I talk about, on Milgram's famous experiment on people giving extreme electric shocks to a stranger, in the Stanford Prison Study in Abu Ghraib, most people conform, comply, do these terrible things, but the good news is there's always some who resist. There's always the minority who don't go all the way. And so either we want to say, well, they must be special people, or what I try to say is, no, maybe they just understand how to resist the con man, how to resist the cult recruiter, you know, how to resist persuasive messages on your television by things we don't need. And then I try to outline, well, what are some of those principles of resistance that I've learned as a kid, you know, from my street smarts, you know, growing up in the ghetto. And then I take it one level further. I said, you know what? People who resist and then go on to challenge the system, those are really heroes.
Mm.
And heroes are not special people. Heroes are ordinary people who do special things. So the heroes, like the heroes in the Holocaust, or this wonderful guy recently, you know, Wesley Autry. He's a 50-year-old African-American who jumped on the subway tracks.
Yes.
And what he said, to save a white guy who had a seizure, fell on the tracks, and was cut in half, he said, I did what anybody could do, and I did what everybody ought to do.
So
he said it didn't take any special ability to jump down the tracks. It wasn't a rocket science thing, I thought. But he said, and it's what everybody ought to do.
Hmm.
But in fact, 75 people were standing on the platform looking and did nothing.
Right.
You know, so essentially, I try to outline in the book that what's really critical, and it's really what all my future research is going to be out of evil. I've been stuck in the evil, you know, swamp for 35 years, is to focus on how is it that we can encourage our children, as well as our family right now, to develop the heroic imagination, to imagine one of us is a hero in waiting, that there's going to be a situation when a lot of people are doing bad stuff, most people are doing nothing, and we're going to take that other path to do two things, to take action instead of being passive, and we're going to be concerned about other people as much or maybe even more so than ourselves in that same situation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I'm glad you're going in that direction. We need that.
I got to do it.
All right. Art from Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
First of all, thanks for what I think is ultimately a message of hope in your study. I just want to relate to you a story from my background. Milwaukee is a very racially divided city, and it was even more so in the 60s. And there were open housing marches from the north side of Milwaukee, which included virtually all the black population, to the south side of Milwaukee, which included virtually none of the black population. And I was just beginning college then, and some friends of mine were marching in the civil rights demonstration, and I wasn't quite ready to do that. But what I did instead is I went basically in front of where the demonstrators were, and I faced the crowd, which was a white mob of people. They were probably throwing bricks at times, but people screaming and yelling, the worst kind of things you could have. And I faced the crowd, and I would make direct eye contact with individuals who were screaming and yelling and doing the worst thing they could. And one after another, when they would see that someone was actually watching them as a person, they would stop, and they would get very uncomfortable, and they would shut up, and they would try and move to another place in the crowd, et cetera. And this is, you know, this is very much vindicated by your study.
But yeah, holding them accountable.
No, I mean, you know, you're downplaying it. That's heroic because they could have seen you as, you know, as the enemy. But again, you know, I mean, in my book, I focus on Abu Ghraib and Rwanda and these terrible things. Just think back how short a time it was where, you know, where white adults would be screaming at little black kids who were simply walking into a school. You know, cursing at them. You know, they had to be police guards protecting the children, you know, against white adults who didn't want black kids in their school. So again, it's you know, the evil is not always only in people. My argument is we have to look at the situations, and then what is the system that creates those situations? So it's a system of racism, or sometimes in Abu Ghraib, what is the military system that created that impossible situation that I detail at great length in my book? And you say, you know, there's something called command complicity. You know, military superiors either know what their subordinates are doing and that they're doing it wrong, or should have known, then they are complicit in whatever that outcome is. And we got to put them on trial as well as the low-level grunts at the end of the chain of command.
Thank you, Art, so much for your call.
I really appreciate that. Wonderful.
Yeah, we'll take more phone calls in a moment. To the author of The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, Philip Zimbardo is our guest, professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford University. He has written a number of other books and created and narrated the PBS series Discovering Psychology. And he also acted as an expert witness in the court-martial proceedings of one of the American Army reservists accused of criminal behavior in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. He also performed the experiment at Stanford University University in August of 1971. I assume many of you in the audience are familiar with this, the Stanford Prison Experiment. All right, back to phone calls in a moment at 800-486-8655. If you are in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Philip. We go next to Peter from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
Earlier, there was reference to an ugly word called de-individuation, I think, and I was wondering if the application of the Lucifer effect is not essential and critical in the training of soldiers, if in fact it isn't necessary to de-individuate before you can become a killing machine. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Peter.
Oh, thanks, Peter, very much. You know, you hate to say it, you know, when you think about our soldiers, but, you know, the training of soldiers in every military throughout the world is training to kill the enemy. If you are not ready, willing, and able to kill the enemy on command, then you are putting your buddies in jeopardy, in threat. So that the entire boot camp training is to get you to first have an image of the enemy. It's called a hostile imagination. And then it's an enemy that you begin to hate, an enemy you're going to kill on sight, either dropping bombs on them or shooting missiles at them or shooting a rifle at them. And one of the things you do, it's not only dehumanizing the enemy, it's you have to be a fighting force. You have to give up your individuality, your morality, all the stuff you are, you know, all the stuff you bring into that point, into the military. At that point, you are a soldier, you are a Marine, and you have to be a killer in the war zone. And so just putting on a uniform, the word uniform means we're taking away individuality, and you become a number. It's name, rank, serial number, and that's who you are. We shave off your head. We take away anything which is unique about you, because we want you to be a soldier, a Marine, and ultimately, sadly, a killer. And the problem is every army is doing that. But you know what? When the war is over, it is against the law to continue to wear your uniform, because when you come home, we want you to be the good little boy you were before you left. And so that's fundamental to every single army, is to de-individuate the soldiers, take away the individuality, and then program them to have an enemy in their mind and an enemy that you want to kill. Yeah. I should mention there's a wonderful reference for your listeners. It's a book by a man named Sam Keen, K-E-E-N, called Faces of the Enemy. And what he has is propaganda, visual propaganda, every single nation has used around the world to prepare their citizens to hate an enemy and for soldiers to want to kill the enemy. And he has those images of that our country did, that Germany did, that Japan did, to create what he calls the hostile imagination.
Let's go next to David from Eau Claire. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. I just make it short. I missed part of it, I think, while I was calling, but I see similarities between the Holocaust and Iraq. Is Iraq American's Holocaust? That's my question.
Okay, the phone's getting a little scratchy. Is Iraq America's Holocaust, in case you didn't hear that, Philip?
Yeah, well, okay. You know, thanks, David. That's a hard question. But, you know, not in the same way. I mean, the Holocaust was, you know, an intentional program of genocide to eliminate a people, all Jews. But then also, it wanted to eliminate Gypsies, eliminate you know, anyone that was seen as of an inferior race, that Hitler had this obsession that he programmed into his people of the superiority of the Aryan race. You know, the historical background of that is, you know, Germany was devastated after the Second World War. They were reduced to physically rubble. There was huge inflation. I mean, the country was nothing. And Hitler helped, you know, create a pride in the country, But it was at the cost of saying, we are great, and the enemy is first the Jews, and then all these other peoples. And then it was, we want to kill every single Jewish person in our country and then in the world. In Iraq, you know, it's really a different, we went in for lots of different reasons. Most of them we realize are spurious or almost lies after the fact. And now we're trapped there. There is no possibility of winning. It's exactly like Vietnam. We continued the Vietnam War 5 years after Robert McNamara later admitted the war was not winnable. And same thing, the war is not winnable, and they're still talking about victory. So it's not that we wanted to kill, you know, Iraqi people, or we want to, destroy, you know, a nation. It's a consequence of our being there. People are dying, and our soldiers are dying. And the question is, how long will it be before we are forced to do the Vietnam mm-hmm. escape, to say the war is not winnable, and we have to leave? And that's the very sad thing about Iraq.
And thanks very much for calling. Spend a few more minutes, if you would, please, Philip, talking about your upbringing. You say that, and you have considered the situational formative force acting on you growing up in poverty and in the South Bronx, your survival by developing useful street smart strategies, figuring out who has power that can be used against you, et cetera. What'd you learn from all of that?
Yeah, Kyle, before I answer that, and I really would like to, I realize I have developed a wonderful website for your listeners. Obviously, it's free. It's at www.lucifereffect.com. And in it, I have everything about the book. There's a Hollywood movie about to be made, everything about me.
Oh, my.
But then I have lots of things. I actually have the pictures of that I described from these Nazi comic books. I have a little video clips of what I call trophy photos of lynchings of blacks in the South, where not only did whites lynch blacks, they took pictures of them, and they took pictures of themselves with the victims of the lynching.
Yeah.
And they put them on postcards. It actually started the postcard industry in America. So I have all of that and more on this website.
Mm.
And then I have some personal things. I have a little autobiography. So I come from a Sicilian background in which nobody ever went to college. Nobody ever went to high school. My parents, I think, may have graduated from elementary school. And all around me, the South Bronx has always been a bad ghetto, I think, is now. But growing up, it did not become really dangerous until heroin came in right after the war in 1948. And then what used to be competitive teams and gangs, where we'd have to fist fight, and maybe sometimes somebody would have a knife. Suddenly, once heroin came in, there were turf, guns came in, and then it was truly dangerous. But what you learn, and I was always a sickly little kid, I almost died from pneumonia and whooping cough, is that you couldn't win by might. You couldn't beat up anybody. So I had to survive by using mental smart. Mm. And that really meant looking around, who are the dangerous kids that you have to avoid? Who are the kids who are tough, but you can ingratiate yourself to them, get them to like you with favors, you know, doing little favors for them. And then always looking at nonverbal behavior, because, you know, you learn about hypocrisy. People say one thing, they do something else. Well, if your survival depends on it, and it does if you're a little kid in a street gang, then everything becomes significant. So you become an observer of human nature. And if you're in privilege, it's a luxury, your survival is not going to depend on any one person in the same way as that. So it's really street smarts. It's really just, you know, being wary, always being suspicious until proven otherwise, never sitting with your back to the door. So it's a lot of little, basic principles that get you to survive. So how do I get through the day without getting hurt? How do I get through the day getting some of what I want in life? What it means is you grow up being what I call a situationist, that you say it's situations that make things happen. You know, you look around and you see failure. Your father's not working, or your brother's on drugs, your sister's prostitute. You don't want to say, gee, it's in my legacy, it's in my genes. because that's the bad news. You want to say, look, you know, things could be better if the situation would change. If you grow up rich, you want to take credit for it. You say, yeah, it's my family, it's my legacy, it's, you know, it's you know, and I got the good stuff from my parents, I'm going to pass it on. So if you come from a privileged background, you're what I call a dispositionalist. You want to think, there are dispositions in me which account for my success, for my fame.
Hmm.
And so the Lucifer effect is really a situationist approach to say, you know, that we have to appreciate more how all of our behavior is shaped by the situations we're in,
mm-hmm.
and that we have to realize that we know very little about what we would or would not do in a new situation. And until we find out what was the situation like in Abu Ghraib, what was the situation like for this young Korean-American boy that led him to do those things, we should not rush to judgment. We should not rush to blame.
Let's go back to phone calls. Tom from Shawano. Hi.
Hi. You've been talking about the Lucifer effect as it applies to the nation state, as it applies to political parties, as it applies to ideologies, large groups, essentially. What I'd like to do is have you take it down to the family unit. And if we're looking at a family, and in particular, looking at a family, say, an older sibling is given power of attorney, and they're given it by a parent, and the remaining parent, and suddenly that power exists with that older sibling over the parent as well as all their siblings, their younger siblings. I'd like for you to apply, how could that, because that seems like a situational effect.
Right.
How can that play itself out? And, ironically, I'm going to put you really to the test, the situation that I have in mind, which I'm not going to go into for obvious reasons, right. actually involves a psychology graduate, PhD from the University of Stanford University.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, one of your colleagues, one of your buddies.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you hit on several interesting points, Tom, is that in the Lucifer effect, I say, in order to understand any behavior, we have to do a three-level analysis. We always have to start with, you know, what does the individual bring into the situation? We have to know everything there is to know about this person, his mental state or her background. But then I'm saying we got to add, let me find out everything I can about the particular situation in which this behavior occurred. And then the third thing is to say, what is the system that created that situation that maintains it? In psychology, the only group of psychologists that have ever focused on the system are those who study families. And they study family as a system, not as a collection of individuals, that different families develop different systems. You know, for some families, for example, where one child is being abused, the other children are not. And the other children know about it, and everybody looks the other way, so that there are in some families, very strange dynamics. One of the worst things that happen in families, as you're hinting at, is where there is power given to one kid, usually it's the oldest son, they call it primogeniture, where the oldest son, in some cases, gets everything and the rest get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Or the oldest one is put in charge of the estate. And then what happens is, you know, then greed starts to surface and power and then hostility, and then you say, no, these are warring nations, not family members.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's something that the parents have created. That is, if they created a sense of, you know, I love all my children, we're sharing, you know, somebody should be in charge of the distribution of money and things, that you don't get this kind of use of money, use of resources as power for the oldest son or the oldest daughter, depending on what the family is. So family dynamics are fascinating. And when they are created in a democratic, caring, loving way, you never get this. It's almost always where parents have somehow, you know, conveyed the sense that some children are worth more than other children, that some children are more loved than other children, that you get these resentments, you get use of power, which is, you know, no different than, as I said, you know, nation states at war against one another.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have.
Oh.
Darn. I know. This is really a good hour. Thank you, Philip, so much for being with us.
Thank you, Colleen. It's an hour. It went fast. So again, go to that website. You're going to absolutely love it.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. For the hour, our guest is Philip Zimbardo. His book is The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. He's a professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford University. The book has just been published by Random House. And if you want to go to the website, it sounds fascinating. It's lucifereffect.com, LuciferEffect.com. And he directs you to that spot and says it's highly, highly interesting. I imagine it is, as is his book. Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing the hour today and to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. They were really good, as they usually are. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 until 11 with more interesting topics. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute now before 11. Stay tuned for the latest news. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.